to Speaking with Joy, a podcast about books, beauty, and music. So make yourself a cup of tea, sit down, and let's begin. Every young man or boy that met her became her son, even if it was only the boy that brought the meat to her back door. Every girl that met her was her daughter. Her motherhood was of a different kind. Those on whom it fell went back to their natural parents, loving them more. Few men looked on her without becoming, in a certain fashion, her lovers. But it was the kind of love that made them not less true, but truer to their own wives. Every beast and bird that came near her had its place in her love. In her, they became themselves. And now the abundance of life that she has in Christ from the Father flows into them. Well, hello everyone, and welcome back to Reading with Joy. If you can believe it, we are on chapter 11 and 12 this week, and this is the second to last week of our summer book club. I'm honestly kind of amazed that you all have made it this far with me, and also that I've actually finished this. It's been a daunting and overwhelming in some ways summer, but it's been fun to be able to have this be an anchor within it. So just to give you a little heads up over the next few weeks, I'll be finishing up the series next week, and then after that we'll have a couple of weeks break, and then I will start back up the podcast kind of for a fall season near the end of August. And I have a lot of exciting announcements for you all. I have some personal news I'm really thrilled to share with you all, but I'm going to save it until I do that kind of launching podcast. And a couple of other things that you can join in on. I've also started planning all of the podcasts for this fall and even recording some of them. And I'm really excited for what I've come up with. And it's been great to have a little more time to kind of think ahead and plan those. So all this to say, keep your ears peeled for once this book club is done. But for the meantime, let's continue on with this book club. And I've loved hearing all of your thoughts. It's been wonderful. I've realized it's been fun to go back through a book that I enjoy and know so well, but also to hear other people's insights on it. And you all have really been interesting and engaging conversation partners. So thank you to all of you who have joined in. So for this episode, we're going to be looking at just chapter 11. And then in the next episode, we'll be looking at chapter 12. And to give you a brief overview, we see that in this chapter there's this wonderful ordinary woman, Sarah Smith, who is praised and lauded and gives delight in life to everyone that she comes near in heaven, as you see in this opening quote that I read. And she's met by who we find out was her husband in life, who is imaged as this little dwarf who is leading a tragedy, or kind of like a marionette, like a puppet. And she is trying to convince him to cast away the chain and be just himself. So not to perform who he is through the tragedian, who's kind of this image of the mask of his ego, but instead to throw that away and to be loved and to love truly as himself. And to me, all of this is, as a good deal of the whole book is asking what it really means to love someone and how love can become something that is a redemptive force and what it looks like when it has truly, like we talked about in the last episode, has been baptized and risen again in its beautiful and glorious form. So to give you a little roadmap for the day, we're going to be talking about three things. First of all is the idea of greatness in heaven, and how greatness is defined by love. And then second of all, we're going to be looking at how the greatest sort of love is a love that gives, that doesn't need. And then finally, we'll be looking at how the mask of pretense prevents us from loving both ourselves and others, and how the tragedian presents to us this kind of choice that to truly love, we have to lay down our ideas of pretense, of being known for how strong and great we are, but to love people truly and to love them as a gift and not out of our own needs and desires. So without further ado, let's dive into those three points. So the first thing I want to talk about is the idea of greatness in heaven. Now, we've seen all throughout this that Lewis loves to go out of his way to surprise us. So in the last, week, we had the mother whose love prevents her from coming into heaven, supposedly, or at least we think it might. And this is shocking, right? Because it's a mother. How could a mother's love ever go sour? And then we have the surprising salvation of the lustful man. And, this is not something that we're expecting. And so finally, we have another surprise here, which is who Lewis presents to us as the great one. And, you see this beautiful kind of parade in the opening of the chapter. And I read a little bit of what MacDonald says about her, that she's this person. She's one of the great ones in heaven. And it's funny because when he says this, Lewis assumes that it's, you know, it's the Virgin Mary, or, and he goes, is it, and he goes, oh no, no one would know her on Earth, but she is one of the great ones here. And so I think what Lewis is doing here is making a point that, that the people who are great according to God's standards are not the ones who are known or famous or who are necessarily known for all their good deeds, but they're for those who love. And it reminds me of this verse from Matthew 23 when it says, "The greatest among you will be your servant, for those who exalt themselves will be humble, and those who humble themselves will be exalted." And Sarah Smith is a picture of someone who in her life was humble, and because of that she has been exalted. We kind of get this image of a person who was so self-giving and loving that everyone around her was brought to life. They were like plants that were watered by her love. And so we see that Lewis is trying to kind of combat this image of greatness and give us a different, surprising image where what is truly makes one great is their love. And it reminds me of, you know, the Sermon on the Mount when you see the way that Jesus turns our ideas of greatness and of virtue upside down. Blessed are those who weep. Blessed are those, you know, it goes through all of these negations, things that we don't think of as great, but that in the economy of heaven, what true greatness is humility and service and love that makes others grow around us. And so what he does to kind of show us this is he paints this beautiful, wonderful scene. And I talked to you all last week about how a lot of this is drawn from Augustine's Confessions. And this is also true with this scene where we talked about how with the lustful lizard, he mimics Augustine's own temptations. And here we see another vision of love redeemed. So in Augustine's, I'm going to read you a passage from Augustine. I think you'll see how these things connect. So this is from Book 8 in Confessions. "I turned my eyes elsewhere, and while I stood trembling at the barrier, on the other side I could see the chaste beauty of continence in all her serene, unsullied joy, as she modestly beckoned me to cross over and hesitate no more. She stretched out her loving hands to welcome and embrace me, holding up a host of good examples to my sight. With her were countless boys and girls, great numbers of the youngest of young people, and people of all ages, staid widows and women who were still virgins in their old age. And in their midst was Continence herself, not barren, but a fruitful mother of children, of joys born to you, O Lord, her spouse." So when I read this in Confessions, I thought, oh, that's such a beautiful image. And then as I started to read through this chapter, I thought, oh, goodness, Lewis is totally drawing from this. So let me read you also this passage from The Great Divorce that describes Sarah Smith and how I think he's kind of using these as similar characters. "First came bright spirits, not the spirits of men, who danced and scattered flowers soundlessly, falling lightly drifting flowers, though by the standards of those ghost worlds, each petal would have weighed 100 weight, and their fall would have been like the crashing of boulders. Then on the left and right, at each side of the forest avenue, came youthful shapes, boys upon one hand and girls upon the other. If I could remember their singing and write down the notes, no man who read that score would ever grow sick or old. Between them went musicians, and after these, a lady in whose honor was all this being done. I cannot now remember whether she was naked or clothed. If she was naked, then it must have been the almost visible penumbra of her courtesy and joy which produces in my memory the illusion of great and shining train that followed her across the happy grass. If she were clothed, then the illusion of nakedness is doubtless due to the charity which, with which her inmost spirit shone through the clothes. For clothes in that country are not a disguise. The spiritual body lives among each thread and turns them into living organs. A robe or a crown is there as much as one's wearer's features as a lip or an eye. But I have forgotten, and only partly do I remember the unbearable beauty of her face." So I think that he's using these two, I think he's drawing from Augustine to paint this beautiful, vivid image of what a person comes when they become truly loving, when the love of Christ flows into them and where they turn outside of themselves. You know, we've been talking about the choice between joy and self. And Sarah Smith is so obviously someone who has turned so completely away from herself that she pours love out on everyone. And just like the fruitful mother of children that Augustine describes, her love brings life to everyone that she touches. So like the lustful lizard man, you know, who becomes the horse that draws him to heaven, in this we see a glorious vision of Sarah's earthly loves baptized and resurrected. And just like in Augustine's thing where it says that she held up a host of examples and stretched out her hands to welcome and embrace him. So Sarah becomes the person who invites this tragedy in, this kind of tragic figure, the dwarf who's carrying the marionette, into heaven. So that's where we get into the idea of love as a gift. So after you see this beautiful parade of people, we come to this kind of strange figure. He's a dwarf. He describes a dwarf who's holding a chain that's carrying along this kind of marionette or puppet. And the puppet speaks for the dwarf. So, and this puppet is very obviously prideful. You know, when you think about, when I read that verse where it says, those who exalt themselves will be humble, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. What I love about this passage is that Sarah Smith is this glorious, radiant being who everyone is almost worshiping, but she kneels down to speak to the tragedian. So she's obviously, even in her greatness does not prevent her humility. Whereas the tragedian, who's kind of this pathetic figure you can barely see, who's speaking out of a puppet, insists on kind of being treated with dignity. And that all boils down to the sort of love that he is willing to give. So we find out that they were married in life, and the thing that seems to be bothering her husband most, and the thing that he's bothered by, is that she is perfectly happy without him, that she has been in heaven enjoying and loving and bringing life and being praised and delighted in, and that she was not unhappy without him. And this is really bothering him. And it comes down to this idea that he is bothered because he wants to love her, but in his love, he wants that she needs to love him. And that boils down to Lewis's idea of need love and gift love. So in The Four Loves, which I highly recommend, also as a side note, it's just amazing to me. The more I read this, the more I see how everything that Lewis wrote is connected with something else he wrote. And it's almost shocking and overwhelming because you can find something that connects to everything. And so this passage really definitely kind of relates to the idea of need love and gift love in The Four Loves, which is also a book by Lewis. So you should look that up. And in this, he describes four different kinds of love. He describes affection, friendship, eros, which is romantic love, and charity. And so let's look at his definition of need love and gift love. He defines need love like this. My Greek lexicon defines storge as affection, especially of parents and offspring, but also of offspring to parents. The image we must start with is that of a mother nursing a baby, a bitch or a cat with a basket full of puppies and kittens, all in squeaking, nuzzling heap together, purrings. Affection is responsible for 9/10 of whatever solid and durable happiness there is in our natural lives. The need and need love of young is obvious. So is the gift love of mother. She gives birth, she gives suck, she gives protection. On the other hand, she must give birth or die. She must give suck or suffer. This way, her affection, too, is a need love. There is a paradox. It is a need love, but what it needs is to give. It is a gift love, but what it needs is to be needed. So I think, obviously, this is pretty neatly describes Pam, who we met last week, someone who does love, but whose love is overshadowed by the need to be loved, or like by the need to love. And this sort of love is not truly love in the long sense of the word. Lewis kind of says that all of the loves are moving towards becoming charity, which is God's love, which is a pure gift. It's not out of any need or desire that we have in ourselves, but out of the desire to give truly to someone. And so if a mother's love, which we saw with Pam, doesn't kind of progress past the need love, then it will become something that's not truly loving. And I think this is also on display with this couple, because the tragedian balks at the idea that Sarah no longer needs him to love her. She admits this kind of dynamic, and she says, I only loved you in a poor sort of way. I have asked you to forgive me. There was a little real love in it, but what we call love down there was mostly craving to be loved. In the main, I loved you for my own sake, because I needed you. And so we see that this is kind of the dynamic. And so the tension is, can the tragedian come to love her if he gives up on her need for him to love her? And so that's kind of this picture, is that Sarah at this point lives in gift love. She no longer needs anything. She says, I am in love himself, and out of him I will not go. All of her needs are filled and delighted. And all of her love now, rather than satisfying her own needs or desires or even her need to be needed, is focused outwards. Whereas the tragedian just can't face up to the idea that she doesn't need him. He wants to be loved because he is needed. And she's saying, you're loved simply as you are. And you can love me simply as I am. And we can not need each other. And instead can just enjoy and appreciate each other. And our love can be true as a gift. And I think that gets back down to that idea last week that we talked about of to set another before you. Now Sarah's at this place where she doesn't need his love anymore. She can just set him before her and enjoy him and appreciate him. But he's having a hard time doing that. And this gives me another wonderful quote that I love from The Four Loves. And it's actually about romantic love and the relationship between need love and romantic love. And it says, need love says of a woman, I cannot live without her. Gift love longs to give her happiness, comfort, protection. Appreciative love gazes and holds its breath and is silent, rejoices that such a wonder should exist, even if it were not for him. And so what we're seeing in this chapter is that the whole rest of heaven seems to already be regarding Sarah this way, but that he can't. There's something that's stopping him because he wants to love her because she is needed or because he needs her. And what he has to learn to do is to love her as a gift love, to not be needed, but simply to give out of the delight of loving and looking at her. And I think that's just such a beautiful picture. And I also think that, you know, even though we're talking about this in this heavenly sense, it also has real repercussions with how we think about loving people. I would say that the times that I have felt the most loved, and also the times when I have loved most, was when it wasn't out of this aching desire to fill a chasm of need that I had, but when I could truly look at someone and just sense how worthy, how valuable, how interesting, how wonderful they were, and just appreciate it, almost to kind of stand in their glory and delight in it. And I think that it's hard to stay in that place because we are all so human and we all have needs and issues and desires and we're all so insecure. But I think that a true love that begins to form is when we can regard people as they are in God and not regard them according to our own need to be needed or our own need to be loved. But that leads us to our last point, which is the mask of pretense. So the thing with Sarah is that she has become fully herself. And I love that it says that because she's become fully herself, she makes everyone around her, through her love, become themselves. And it seems like the issue with the tragedian, and this is kind of very obviously depicted as he has this marionette, is that he is not himself and that he is presenting kind of this performative manliness. So that's kind of when we talk about what's the deal with this puppet. That's the issue. And we've talked about this before. If you love people for what they can give you or how they make you feel, you're not truly loving them, but an illusion or projection of them. But I think this also reflects on us. So it's true of ourselves. If we become the illusion of what we think other people need or desire based out of our own desire to be needed. And this is kind of what's happened with this character. He needs to be needed. And so he's become this illusion of the person he thinks needs to be needed. And this is so easy to do. And he does it in this very kind of masculine way. He's kind of a man, we've all met people like this, a man who's being what he thinks a man should be, not being the true man that God created him to be and just living into his capacity. So the tragedian is the projection of what Sarah's husband thinks he needs to be to get her to love him and to make her need him. And so his true self no longer speaks, but instead this kind of performative, manly projection. I got a kick out of the part where it says, "Look here," said the tragedian, "we've got to face this." He was using his manly bullying tone at this time, the one for bringing women to their senses. I was amused by this, partially because if you've been on the internet, I'm sure we've all had trolls out there who have used their manly bullying tone to bring women to their senses. But in general, what he's kind of pointing out here is that it's kind of a facade. He's pretending. He's trying to be a man. He's not just being who he was. And obviously, Sarah is not interested in this facade. She's interested in loving him. And this comes out in the next scene when she says, "I cannot love a lie." She, because she is in love, she's no longer loving out of her own desires or feelings. She's loving truly. She cannot love him unless she is able to love the dwarf, the actual person, not the performative part of who he is. So he tries to become great and manly, but he's become literally a puppet of himself. And to be redeemed, he must put away his mask and reckon with his wife as the true person he is. And you kind of wonder, too, do you think he's truly relating to her, or do you think in his own mind he's relating to a projection of her as well? He has to put away his projection of himself and instead relate to her as a person. And I think to close this, I want to make a point, which is that Sarah never addresses the puppet. She only addresses the man. So throughout the whole thing, once you get to the next chapter, she addresses the puppet because he's kind of swallowed. But she is always not talking to the projection that he gives, but to the man himself, no matter how clouded he is by his own pretense. And I think that this to me is also a picture of what God's love does to us, that he does not relate to us according to how we project ourselves or present ourselves, but according to who we are truly. And that at the bottom of that, we may be silly and small and sinful, but that repentance and moving forward and health, whether that is psychological or spiritual, comes with not allowing ourselves to look at the projected self, but instead to look at the true self, and that there we find true love and contentment, and that as we do that, we begin to become these Sarahs whose self-love flows out of us and makes everyone else around us more themselves. And I think that's a really interesting picture, is that the more I think the people who act as pretense make other people around them act as pretense and illusion, whereas Sarah is so herself that she makes everyone around her feel like themselves. So that is chapter 11, and we'll be getting into chapter 12 very shortly. I'll be posting that very soon. But for now, please think on these things and let me know what you think about this chapter. And particularly think for yourself. Don't just think on a philosophical level. Think about how do you, because I know I do this certainly, use the mask of pretense to love people as your own illusion, to let them only see a version of who you are, rather than bringing your true self to God and the people you love, and allowing being yourself to make others feel more themselves, and worrying more about being humble and loving, because that is true greatness. So much love to you all, and I will talk to you soon.